Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Subby Construction Community Podcast, also known as the SCC Podcast. I'm James Gilbert, and the founder of Subby, and I've put this podcast together because it's a great way of getting the best minds, the best voices to your ears. And I'm hoping we can do that. We're going to do that through a variety of different guests. We're going to talk about mental health in construction. We're going to talk about how we can do better, why we should do better. We're going to cover everything. So for our first guest, we've got Michael Byrne here today. Michael is 49, married with a three-year-old son and lives in Glasgow. Me and Michael met recently through LinkedIn, through a mutual friend connection, and Michael shared his story with me. And to be bluntly honest, it blew me away. It's something I'm passionate about, mental health. I've had my ups and downs with it from starting this business, and it's really important to me to get people talking. So that's what Michael is here today to do, is to share his story, tell us about everything from his complex PTSD, his love for music, especially Paul Weller, and the fact of the matter that he's not ashamed to say he struggled with mental health. So here we go.
James.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, James. How are you? All right?
Yeah, good, good, good. Good. So you can hear me all right then, yeah?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, brilliant. All right. Okay, so just, I'll give it a second, and then you got to sit. And then we're ready to rock and roll. Okay, so you all set?
Yep. Can you hear me okay? Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Right, okay. Give it a couple of seconds, and I'll start, okay? Okay, so welcome, Michael. It's nice to have you here. You had a good day?
Yeah, it's been a great day, thanks. I've been doing a talk today with Zurich Insurance in Glasgow and just kind of raising awareness about mental health and emotional well-being in the workplace and how important it is for staff and for organisations to take mental health and emotional well-being on board. So it's been a great day.
Great, great. Before we get started, I know that you told me you're a Paul Weller fan. So tell me, your favourite Paul Weller song.
Oh, I've got so many, James. What I have tattooed on my arm is a lyric from "You Do Something to Me."
Yeah, okay.
And I like the line, "I'm dancing through the fire just to catch a flame to feel real again."
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of has a significance for me as well. I take a deeper meaning for that line, just about trying to keep yourself alive sometimes and... you dance through the fire to feel real, because sometimes you feel nothing, you feel pain, and you want to feel something different. So that's why I've got it in my arm, just as a reminder sometimes that, it's okay sometimes to feel that way,
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, we've obviously spoken a bit already, and I've heard a lot about your experiences in life and what you've been through, and we will get into that, definitely. But I just first... what does the future hold for you? Where are you and what are you doing now?
Well, James, the last couple of months I've been setting up my own business. It's called Lived Experience Trauma Support, and it's an acronym for LETS, as in let's talk, let's help, let's support. Let's solve this epidemic that we have with mental health, and particularly in men, where, the suicide rates and so on are an epidemic for men. So I've set up my own business, and the view of the business so far is to educate employers, as I was saying I'm doing today in Zurich, is to educate employers that to take better care of the mental health and emotional well-being of their staff, and to try and create an environment where it's okay for staff, it's okay for the boys and girls who turn up to work every day to say, look, I'm not feeling great. And I and my organisation will be the providers of support for those people based on lived experience. It's not based on counselling. It's not based on psychiatry. It's at an entry level where if you've got any concerns or any experiences that you'd want to talk about, the likelihood is I or my business will have something similar. And we'll take you for a coffee. We'll take you for a walk around the local park. We'll take you somewhere that you feel really comfortable and we'll have a chat about it.
Yeah.
We won't make it out with your head. We won't do anything like that. We'll just teach you some coping strategies and then we'll move on from there and we'll try and get you into perhaps some holistic therapies. But it's all at an entry level for businesses to educate the businesses about, your staff are turning up in some instances where they're not fit to work, but they're turning up because they think they have to be there because perhaps their salary concerns, reputation concerns. If you have a different approach to your staff, they will engage far better. And ultimately, for the sake of the business as well, you will get more productivity from your staff.
Yeah.
Your staff are happier coming into work and an employer who engages well with them. So that's what we're trying to do here in Glasgow.
Yeah, because I think this was something in our initial phone calls that we touched on, and I think we both agreed on, is whilst, yeah, there is, okay, the medical side to it, and there's definitely a need for that, I think to get that initial conversation or chat or coffee, like you say, going, it needs to just be a bit more relaxed. I think that sometimes, especially with the demographic of people, and myself being a tradesman and knowing the kind of people I'm around, that coming at me with therapy, and it's kind of puts people's, not backs up, but it gets them, it makes them a bit more standoffy. Whereas maybe, to put it lightly, like you say, a coffee, maybe even a pint. Let's just go for a pint and have a chat.
Yeah, absolutely, James. I mean, one of the things we do is I run a men's mental health support group on a Thursday night in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. And initially we were having it in the local community centre, and we were all sitting around, and there's half a dozen seats or so on, and it felt very, it felt awkward because, it's not a natural environment for anyone. So we ended the lease, and there was a pub across the road from it. And I said to the boys, let's just go to the pub. And we've been there ever since. Now, what traditionally the reputation that blokes have about no talking is that, they don't talk about it. They go to the pub with their mates. They talk about football and women and politics and everything like that. That leads to alcoholism and no talking about it. We're absolutely breaking the mold where, there's 6-10 guys sitting in a bar having a pint or an orange juice or a glass of water talking about mental health. And we believe that we can break that, that reputation that you go to the pub to get drunk to not talk about your mental health. Where here's a group of guys in Glasgow sitting having a pint or whatever and actively engaging in that, and we're there for the purpose of talking about our mental health. So, I think we're just trying to break that mold and that stigma of, times are changing, James, as you know. It's no stereotypes anymore. We need to break the mold. And I think, having a meeting in a pub where you can sit and talk about your mental health or how your week's been or how you're no great, that's incredibly empowering for a lot of guys. And if they can do that with their mates, the next time they go to the pub, if they can do that with a group with support, next time they go to the pub with their mate, they're likely to maybe ask their mate, are you okay? Are you all right? Because I go to a wee group and I'm confident now about talking in a pub about mental health, so hopefully
better. I completely agree with you. I mean, when we spoke before and I told you about, the kind of past couple of years with starting the business and the financial difficulties and the stress and everything I'd been through. And when I actually got to a point where I felt better, that was when I chose to tell my closest friends. And actually, as I told you, Michael, they were disappointed. They were annoyed because I'd gone through 2 years of feeling that way. I'd not shared it. How many times have we been in the pub? How many times have we been at the football? Where all these times have we been there? And I was just keeping it to myself. I definitely agree with that. The initial, just get a conversation going, get it started. And I think this will all come to light now as we move on to where it all started with you, Michael. So, I mean, tell us more about your past traumatic events and also that you suffer with complex PTSD. I've said that the right way, haven't I?
Yeah.
So tell us a bit more about that, Michael.
Sure, it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it, trying to say complex?
It is.
My diagnosis came last year, and I was the happiest man alive, I think, to be diagnosed with complex PTSD. But it was a culmination of a lot of traumatic events in my life, James, and I'll do a wee whistle stop tour of them. So for instance, as a child, I was abused by both of my parents, and I lived in a very violent household. I witnessed my mother stab my father. I witnessed my father attempt to strangle my mother. So it was a very, very violent household, and I was abused on a daily basis. But my earliest memories are all about fear. I continued until probably only about a year ago, I lived my life in fear of everything, of letting people down, of being being violently abused and so on. When I was 16, I left the household. I couldn't live with my father any longer. I moved out, but within a short period of time, I came back. And it's very difficult when you move back. Your father doesn't want to speak to you. You're almost like disowned. And then, you know, I had to kind of stick with it for a few years. I had nowhere to go. I had no money. I was working, but, you know, I couldn't pay rent and mortgage and so on. And then when I was 24, I got married. I was in the process of moving out. And on my wedding day, my mother and father told me that they were divorcing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was a wedding gift to me or not.
But,
a really unfair thing to do. But ironically, that started a better relationship with my father, and for the next 2 years, my relationship got better. And then when I was 26, my father was brutally murdered. Mm. He was beaten to death in his household by someone who he woke up and found stealing his television. My father was near fire. He's only 5.5 foot, but this guy was an ex-army boxer and beat him to death. So pretty traumatic time. And then my marriage just kind of fell apart after that. I didn't know how to speak about it. There were no support groups around. But equally, James, I was a 26-year-old guy. I wasn't going to talk to MD. I wasn't going to let my feelings show. I was going to hit the pub.
Seeing what you saw as a young man or child or however you want to look at it, were you aware that it was bothering you? Because I know we talk a lot about this. Things go on in children's lives, but were you aware of it? Were you aware of the problems or issues it was causing or giving you?
I knew that I never wanted to be in the household. Mm. So looking back, my mother would always say to me, all you ever want to do is go and play football.
Mm.
But she missed the point. All I ever wanted to do was not be in the house.
Yeah.
So could have been stamp collecting or anything like that. I would have gotten told with anything not to be in the household. So I was aware of it. But I actually thought that was a normal environment to be in. I thought everybody's parents did that. I never asked anyone, do your parents do that? But, I just thought it was. But for me, I was always in fear. I was in fear of my father and my mother beating me up and abusing me. So I never wanted to be in the house. So I was aware that I was like that. But the dichotomy of it was that I thought that's what everyone's household was like.
Mm.
It's
a weird question and a strange question. You might be able to shed some light on this. But I look at, so I hear your story now, what you've said, and I think about my issues. And I say to myself, James, they're not issues. What Michael went through are issues. And this is what I think I want to try and really do is try and get across whether you think compared to someone else or someone else's life that your problems aren't nothing. They're still your problems and they still are a problem. Do you see where I'm going with this? Is how the weight of the situation should not have any bearing on someone like you. I mean, yourself not talking, because you've admitted and been open with the fact that you didn't want to tell anyone. And what's concerning about that is your situation was what I would class it as severe and not very nice, but yet you still at that point didn't want to talk to anyone. So if you're a person, you've got financial difficulties, or maybe you're just having an argument with the wife, or you're having problems with the children or something, how do we get people talking?
Yeah, absolutely, James. See, for me, I didn't want to speak about it because I didn't want to be judged. Mm. I felt that if I opened up and spoke about it, and perhaps a little bit like yourself with your mates or whatever, but I thought if I opened up and told someone, they would judge me. And I was terrified of being judged.
Mm.
I was terrified of being judged because I thought that you would think less of me. I was trying to present a persona that would make you think, well, he looks okay. Because if you asked me if I wasn't okay, the chances were that I was going to break down and cry.
Mm.
And as a man, I didn't want to be seen as the type of guy who, breaks down and cries, because that's a stigma and all of those things.
Yeah.
But having no judgment, if we can get an environment, James, and I know that's what we're trying to do, and that's what we're trying to do up here too, is create an environment where men in particular won't be judged by saying, do you know what, I'm not feeling it today and I've got some real problems and I just want to get them out. And could you listen to me and talk to me about it? Yeah. And see once, and I know this from my own experience, James, it took me 47 years to open up. And since then, I'm proud to admit that I've been through all of that stuff. I'm proud to chat with yourself about it, because I think if I can talk about it, it might help somebody else, because the people who I spoke to didn't judge me. And I will love every one of them to the day I die, because as soon as you realise that you're not being judged, you'll tell anybody your whole life story because you're not thinking that they're thinking any less of you. So I think that's the way to go forward. If we can create an environment that's not judging men and we can affiliate and rely on each other without judgment, that's the way to go in my mind. Non-judgment and plenty of support.
Definitely. I mean, I go back to when I finally kind of opened up with my friends about how the last 2 years had been and the ups and the downs, but more really the downs and how bad it really did get for me. It was just a weight off my shoulders. Yeah, I could felt my shoulders just drop down. You know, I didn't realize they were like up by my ears for like 2 whole years, and finally just dropping down and letting it kind of letting it out. You know, it's just it was a great feeling, and that's why I think I'm so focus on working with you and how and what we can do to get people talking, because the simplest little conversation can make all the difference.
Absolutely. That is the most incredible thing for me. When I, you know, I know we'll get to it, but when I eventually had my breakdown and I was almost forced into talking about it because, you know, the signs were there, I was broken. You know, the second person I spoke to, not the first person, but the second person I spoke to was the one that made all the difference to me. And it's incredibly empowering, as I said. Just, you know, you don't have to be educated. You don't have to have all the academia. You don't have to do all that. I don't have any of that. All I've just got is experience of being through some things that I can relate to people about. I have no special power, special skill, special ability, nothing. I haven't been to uni or nothing like that. I'm just a bloke. But I through my traumatic experience, I can engage with people. I can talk to people, but they can say something and say, you know, understand where they're coming from. And for me, that's so empowering for people, you know.
Yeah, I mean that we're coming on to the, you know, the suicide attempt and that part of your life. I know you've told me, you know, at that point you had a son, you had a wife, you had a car, you had everything there. And this question is actually, I think it's so important for someone to listen to understand more about the silent person or about the person who's got all that, looks okay, but isn't okay. So tell us more about that period in time and everything that you went through there. Because obviously people were not, up until it happened, people were not really aware of how bad it was for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd been through, after the murder of my father, there were a few traumatic events in my life. And one of them in particular in 2013 was what's called in Glasgow the Clutter disaster. Mm. And that is, I was standing in a pub where a helicopter crashed into it. 10 people of it. So it's a pretty horrendous time. And it happened the night, and I went to my work on the Monday morning. You know, a strange thing to do, and I regret it ever since because it's primarily resulted in a lot of problems for me. Within that next year, I was diagnosed with a throat tumour that was potentially cancerous. I was diagnosed with PTSD as well. I had to go into hospital and have the tumour removed. And then in 2017, I was involved in a car crash, and within 3 or 4 days, I was admitted to hospital with symptoms of a potential stroke. And that point in April 17 was the start of my breakdown. What was going through my mind after that, James, was I kept getting flashbacks about the car crash. Because they hit me side on, I never seen them coming. That linked me then to the helicopter crashing into the pub and the bodies and so on. And that led me to having to identify my father's body in the city morgue. But, you know, he was beaten to death. And my father was murdered when he was 48, and I was just about to turn 48. So it was a little bit of a perfect storm for me. And I then went about sabotaging everything in my life because I needed somebody to help me. But for 47 years, I had never asked anyone for help, and I didn't know how to go about asking for help. So I kind of became the sort of naughty child thing. You know, you get no attention if you're a good child, but you get plenty when you're a bad one. So I then became really bad in the workplace, missing deadlines, you know, crying out, you know, signs of help, you know, just making everything aware to people that I wasn't the same person without being asking, but nobody helped me, and the same in my private life. And then in January 2018, my breakdown was complete. I was suspended from my work because of my actions. My work didn't support me. They decided to take a punitive measure upon me. And the traumatic events in my life, James, I'd always been at my work the next day. that was no longer there. So that led to 4 or 5 months of me being in complete despair. And it culminated in May of last year, where I decided that I'd had enough of the pain. I was in so much pain that I wanted to complete suicide. And I planned to do it a Wednesday morning, just in early May, when my son gets watched by his grandmother. The couple of nights leading up to it, I was happier than I'd ever been. And certainly the night before I was about to complete suicide, I was happy. I wasn't happy that I was going to leave my son and my wife and everything else behind. I was happy because the pain inside me was going to be ended. Mm. I woke up that Wednesday morning, James, and my wife had a text message from her mum to say that she'd been unwell during the night and couldn't watch my son. Could Michael just watch him? And it was just as simple as that. I said, no, I can't watch him. I've got plans today. And I couldn't tell my wife what those plans were. And ultimately, I did watch my son. And I knew that I was in a dangerous place. I was never going to do anything with my son. But I wanted to escape my life because I wanted to end the pain that I was in.
Mm.
The pain isn't like a pain when if you twist your ankle, if you have a medical injury. It wasn't like that. It was pain in my chest and my soul and my whole being, whatever. It's an unexplainable one, but it was just too much for me. And I knew that I wanted to end my life. And it made me happy that I was going to end my life.
Because you felt free of everything that you had been going through. Yeah.
It wasn't I wanted to escape my wife, financial worries, anything like that, my son, nothing like that. I wanted to escape the pain. Mm. And if I'd have known a way of how to deal with the pain, I wouldn't have wanted to do it. I wouldn't have wanted to end my life. But I knew of no way because I wasn't getting any help. Nobody was listening. I was trying to attend support groups. But because what I had, when you start talking to people about helicopters crashing into pubs, it's kind of off the chart for a lot of people, but that's because it was the wrong groups. I just didn't know of the right people to talk to. So that's why I wanted to end it. I just thought I had no salvation. I could find no redemption. I know those are big kind of heavy words, but I just wanted to get out of the pain I was in, just in simple terms. I'd had enough. The pain was just overbearing. It was all consuming.
Mm.
And, I'm ashamed to say it, but it was the place I was in that even living for my son and my wife at that point in time wasn't enough to keep me from doing what I wanted to do. My mindset was that my son at that point was 2. If I ended my life just now, he would grow up never knowing me, and that would be a good thing for him. And I know that doesn't sound great, but I thought that was a good thing for him at that point in time. And I don't think my thinking was bad or anything like that. It's just where I was at that point in time. It just shows the amount of pain that I was in, that's how far I was willing to go to save other people.
But yeah, I was just going to say, it shows the real gravity of the situation. It really shows where exactly you were to speak honestly like you do now about thinking that and about feeling that way. It really does show the gravity of the situation. So obviously it didn't happen, but yeah. What did happen from that minute onwards?
From that, well, I started communicating with my wife and my mates, but nobody could understand. It kind of seemed strange because a bit like what you said with your own mates, James, I was telling my mates and they were saying, we don't understand, but you've got a son, you've got a wife, you've got a car, you've got a house. But all of those things were extrinsic. No one could see inside me and kind of, everybody was just kind of judging me from the outside. I don't mean judging me, looking at what I've got from the outside in. And I was saying to my wife as well, and my wife was devastated because she was thinking, what, you want to leave your son and I? And so I ended up stopped talking to them about it because I was creating more pain for them by talking about it. So what I did do was I looked into setting up a support group for, just blokes to come along and in an environment that perhaps wasn't their wife, wasn't their mates, because maybe they're not the right people to talk to. And I thought, oh, I'm just being a burden. Not that I wanted to commit suicide, I'd kind of moved on from that, but I wanted to help me and help other people in the same way. And I also, this kind of sounds a bit silly, but I started writing poetry. Because my view was that if you can't understand me when I'm talking to you, and I don't blame anybody for that because I think you have to be in that situation, maybe you'll understand what I write. And I would openly show my mates, I wasn't embarrassed about writing poetry. It's not a big thing in Glasgow. If you go with reputation and stigma, we don't have many poets and so on. But I didn't care about that. My view was that if you didn't understand what I was saying, maybe you could understand what I was writing. That was I'd leave my poetry writings kind of in a book, and I'd say to my wife, if you want to read it anytime, it's not private, you read it anytime you want. And I'd meet my mate, I know it sounds silly, I'd meet my mate in the pub for an Iron Brew or a Coke or whatever, and I would take my poetry book with me and I'd say, there's what I've written the last couple of days. And it helped because they didn't need to have that awkward conversation, and I could show them, look, here's kind of what I'm thinking. So it was very cathartic for me, and it helped in a lot of ways, and it kind of built my confidence up as well, that I didn't need to communicate it with people close to me, because I now started developing a support network of guys, of other people. Then that was incredibly empowering, as I said, because it's almost like, okay, I know that if I get to that point on a Thursday night, I can sit in with guys, sit in a bar with guys, and we'll all talk about our mental health, and we'll talk about what's on it. And I can spare my wife and my mates from that. I'm not hiding it from them. That's just my safe environment to go to and speak to them about it. And had it been in a workplace, I would have done it in my workplace, or I would have done it whatever that safe environment was. It was just that was the one I had at that point in time. You know,
it's interesting to look at that. And it's I want to make maximize how we share this and how we capture kind of just about everyone and every situation. And I got to a point where, like you say, I was trying to explain to my friends, but they didn't understand the thought of failure or the frustrations and everything I was going through. You ultimately, I believe that your parents always tell you what you want to hear most of the time. And I actually reached out to a company that basically effectively become a board for your company, but you see them once or twice a month. And that allowed me a neutral ground to go and vent with no opinion of family or friend or no opinion of investor. It was a neutral place for me to vent my problems and deal with my problems. And I think similar to like what you're saying, the poetry and that allowed you a way to communicate your problems and what you were going through. Because I'm right in saying that the poetry was a direct, the poem or poems were a direct of what you were thinking and what you were going through.
Yeah, absolutely, James. The first two poems I wrote, the first one was called The Final Chime and the second one was called Ember. And both of them are about me committing suicide. So The Final Chime, I wrote it in like 5 minutes, and it's all about, you know, the final chime of your life, you know, and The Ember was about, you know, if you're being cremated, your last ember, your last part of you being just, you know, going out. And I wrote the two of them very easily, because that's exactly where I was. It was easy for me to write them, and I'm not saying that's of any standard, but it was almost like if I could write it, it would get out of me. If I could explain it in poetry, it wasn't in me any longer. But, you know, the more I wrote poetry, the more it might not be in me, if that makes any sense at all. So I ended up writing quite a bit in those early days, just to, you know, and I wrote a poem about my dad, I wrote a poem about my mum, I wrote a poem about the Clutha disaster. So these big memorable events, I thought if I write them down, it's out there.
Yeah, gave you a way to let it out, so to speak. Yeah,
absolutely. It meant that I could write them, and see, once I wrote them, it meant that I didn't need to go back and read them unless I wanted to, and I didn't need to write about them again. I kind of thought to myself, right, I've written it, that's it, and that's my way of dealing with it. I'm not saying I'm cured from it or anything like that, but it kind of got the feeling out of me for that moment in time until the next feeling would come along and I'd write about that or whatever it may be, you know. So I think you're right what you say. I mean, if you can get bored, if you can get anyone, a mate, the easiest thing to do for me was to talk to complete strangers and support groups. Because when you talk to family, or I thought when I talked to family, friends, even with the best will in the world, people still judge you. You know, mates still judge me because you've got a relationship with them. And just like your own mates say, they get hurt because you didn't speak to them, but you're trying to spare them and you're trying to spare yourself, and it's a difficult thing to do, you know?
Definitely. Before we finish up, I want to grab a couple of bits of advice from you. So from one point of view, the person that's suffering, the person who's got the problem, but I think what's important is to get a bit of advice from you for the person who is aware that someone is suffering or someone is struggling, but they don't quite know how to approach it. So just to get those two bits of advice from you before we finish up, that'd be fantastic, Michael.
Yeah, to be honest, James, it's probably the same bit of advice for both of them. for the person who's struggling, I would say, you know, find a safe space, find a support group, find something like that, find an online app. There's plenty of them. I can recommend them myself if anybody wants to get in contact through yourself. But there are plenty of people willing to speak. There are people like myself and like yourself, James, who've been through things. And if you can find someone like that, they will help you. For the other side of it, James, if you are the person like that, help and don't judge.
Agreed.
Not judging anyone is the most important thing. If you think that someone is struggling or suffering in some way, all you have to do is ask twice. Ask the person, are you okay? The chances are they'll say, I'm fine, but ask again. And that's likely to be the most impact you can make. When you ask again and you show the person that you care and you're not going to judge them, that's all that matters. And the person, the chances are that the person will open up to you because they trust you.
That's absolutely fantastic. Thanks for that, Michael. And thanks for being here today. Really appreciate you sharing. And hopefully once you move forward with the new business, we'll get you back on again and hear more about how it's all going.
Great. My pleasure, James. Anything I can help, mate. Thank
you. Brilliant, Michael. Take care. Thank you.
You too, mate. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I hope everyone enjoyed listening to Michael's story. I certainly know I did. Lots to take from it and definitely lots more work to continue. I really look forward to what me and Michael can do working together, you know, with a real focus on getting construction talking. So thanks everyone for listening and for the rest of these podcasts. Let's hear your feedback. You can email me at james.gilbert@subbyjobs.com or LinkedIn, anywhere on social media. All the links will be attached. So I look forward to seeing you again, and I hope you enjoyed listening. Thanks.